Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm George Scalise, former president of the Semiconductor Industry Association, and a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for tonight's program. I'm now pleased to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Duff Sundheim, Republican candidate to represent California in the U.S. Senate and former chair of the California Republican Party. Amidst sharp dissension in the National Republican Party over their prospective presidential nominee, some pundits have said that our speaker today is a decidedly temperate Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. Duff Sundheim has been active in Republican politics since he served as a page in the Illinois State Legislature at age 18. He double-lettered in football at Stanford University while obtaining his economics degree and went on to get a law degree from Northwestern University. He advocates for government reform, talks about the applying technological advances to government to unleash a new era of freedom and make government more responsive to the citizens. His supporters include former Secretary of State George Shultz, Charles Schwab, and U.S. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. To discuss his vision for California and the country, please welcome Duff Sundheim.
Thank you, George. Well, thank you, George, for that introduction. Thank you all for being here tonight. This has been one of the great experiences of my life. I'm going to talk tonight about kind of my vision of where we're going as a civilization. But I'd really like to start with explaining to you what really drives me. Because what drives me isn't the big philosophical things. It's not even the battle between left versus right. What really drives me is trying to make a difference in people's lives. And that comes very much from my personal experience. I had a brother that had a mental disability. So even though I was doing very well in football, and I was going to go play football at Stanford, I had the lead in the senior class play, and people on the outside thought I had things really going for myself. When I would go home, I'd go home to a brother that had a mental disability. And my mom would be with my brother in the basement. And my brother would be saying, "Mom, I just can't do this anymore." And my mom would be saying, "But David, you just have to." Because she was afraid of losing her son. And I was upstairs totally hopeless and helpless, afraid of losing my brother. Fortunately, it ended up that he wasn't institutionalized. He went on to live a great life. He was the best man in my wedding. But all through, I experienced government programs. I saw how they helped. I saw how they hurt. And so my whole experience and the way I look at things is, how does it impact the individual? But I want to get that background because I'm going to talk now about some pretty big picture ideas of what I see going on and why I think this is the most exciting time in the history of civilization. Because I believe we're on the verge of what I call the second age of reason. You know, before the first age of reason, there was the kings and queens, and we thought the world was flat. And then Gutenberg came up with the Bible, and it set off an explosion of scientific adventure, new philosophies, and it eventually led to political change. 3 million people living on the east coast of the New World said, "We don't need the kings and queens anymore. We can be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people." And that was a tremendous change. And we've played that out now for over 200 years very successfully, better than, I believe, many places on the face of the earth. But now, over time, that power has become consolidated in Washington through economies of scale and other important developments that occurred that encouraged that type of process. What do I mean by that? Well, we had, the civil rights movement, right? And so you had people like Alabama and Georgia that were doing things that weren't right. So the role of the federal government was important. But we also had economies of scale and efficiencies, and there's a centralization of knowledge in Washington. So that all made sense. But now we're on the verge of what I call the second age of reason, and that's changing everything. If you think about what happened just this month, Kepler mission, right? We now may find out that there are other people in the universe that are alive. And just as we thought before the first age of reason that the world was flat, we then learn that the sun actually revolved around the earth rather than the earth around the sun, vice versa. I do know that, actually. But that was a tremendous change, and it changed our vision of our place in the universe. And knowing that there may be other life, that how that will change our perspective of where we stand in relationship to each other. I mean, and how petty some of our differences look relative to what may be going on in the rest of the universe. But just look at the technology. Look at our phones. Look at our, we have more information in our hand than the people that put the man on the moon. And now we can communicate with 7 billion people. So where it used to make sense to have this tremendous concentration of power in Washington, it's now scientifically provable that that no longer makes sense. And how is that playing out in our society? Well, if I would have told you 5 years ago that the largest bookseller wouldn't own a bookstore and the largest cab company wouldn't own a cab, you wouldn't have any understanding of what I'm talking about. But that makes more sense. And the metaphor to our federal government, I think, is very appropriate. Because in the cab companies, you still have the dispatcher. And he is the centralization of power and knowledge. And you have these cabs lined up for a mile outside San Francisco. So it's inefficient in terms of that dispatcher now doesn't have all the knowledge. The knowledge is dispersed. And also it doesn't make sense to have a mile-long group of cabs. And that's what I think we really are going to be going away from, a system where Washington is the centralization of power to where that power is dispersed. And I've done about 40,000 miles. I've had about 400 meetings around the state. And I am seeing that on the ground in local government. Because the quality of our school boards, the quality of the Board of Supervisors, the quality of the people that are running the city councils, they really have gone up dramatically because they're no longer isolated. They have access to all that information and they're able to come up with those great programs. So you've seen all these tremendous changes in the way we live, work, and play on the individual level, but there's no change in government. And so there's this huge yawning gap between how people live their lives day to day and what's going on in the government. You know, it can take longer to get a building permit than it took the Allies to beat the Nazis in World War II. And so that gap is what part of the frustration that people are feeling. They're feeling disconnected from their government. And I think that's a major change. So we can talk about what the role of government is going to be going forward, because I think that's going to dramatically change what the proper role of government is, what government should do, what government can do, and all the things that it no longer can do. So if you just look at our healthcare policies, why would we have the centralization of 1/6 of our economy in Washington? Why not have it built around what the needs are of the individual citizen, the patient, and the doctor? So those types of changes will be occurring. I'm not saying we're not going to have any government anymore, but I think the role will fundamentally change. And that's one of the key things that's going to happen in the races ahead. In my race, one of the leading candidates, if you go to their webpage, everything is greater Washington power, more government programs, more government control, more centralization. And my feeling is it's scientifically proven that we can take the other approach. We can have the decentralization. So I think the amount of information we have is a key difference. Now, the paradox is, as much as we have more knowledge, we need to better understand the role of emotion. Because we, as much knowledge as we have, as human beings, we still make our decisions based on our emotions. And I'm a federal court mediator, a state court settlement judge. And when you work as a mediator, the first level of mediator is that you understand that the people before you are driven by their emotions. And so you understand, okay, well, this case hasn't resolved itself for the last 3 or 4 years because people are looking as if the facts make the difference. But what really makes the difference is the emotions. Then when you become a really good mediator is that you realize that you're driven by your emotions just as much as the people in front of you are driven by theirs. And that you find at 2 o'clock when the mediation isn't going well, oh my gosh, you know, my success rate, if this doesn't work out, is going to go down to 72%. And I wonder what, you know, and so you have to bring that type of mentality to the process, that everybody that's involved in the process is dealing with things from an emotional perspective. And we don't understand that or live that in our politics at all. Just think of how we look at each side, right? Oh, those people are crazy. Oh, those people are driven by their emotions. And we see that we see how the other side is driven by their emotion, and we don't see how we are equally driven by ours. In terms of how it plays out in this election, I think you see both sides. Both Bernie Sanders on the left is playing to the emotions that people can get something for nothing, blame the banks. And on the Trump side, obviously there are real limitations in terms of the intellectual side of his argument and how he's really tapped into something very emotional, very raw that people feel. I feel great leaders understand that emotion, but also deal with the practical side as well. And who would be an example of that? It would be Franklin Roosevelt. And even though I disagree with a lot of his policies, my feelings are is that he understood what those emotions were. He said, we had nothing to fear but fear itself. And then he showed respect for those emotions because on an ongoing basis, he would have the fireside chats. So he always showed respect for those raw emotions. But at the same time, he developed the policies that really led us out of the Depression. Some would say it continued it longer because some of those policies weren't the right ones, but it was that dual approach of understanding both the emotion and the need to deal with specific policies. And I think that's missing from the presidential debate so far. And we need to develop the discussion on what's going on in terms of the policy, and I hope to do that as part of our campaign. The other aspect of the emotion is when I work with mediation, I had a couple that came in and they were divorced and they had a child that they were having visitation issues, and they'd gone through every segment of the court system and had failed to resolve their issues. So they came to me as kind of a last resort, and they came into the room and they were both arguing, and I just sat down and let them talk for 45 minutes. And the person, I had a family law specialist with me because I'm not a family law specialist. She's kicking me under the table, you know, hey, you know, stop this stuff. And I felt like, you know, I wanted to really let them go. And at the end of the 45 minutes, I said, okay, Mary, clearly you have some issues with John that we're not going to be able to resolve here today. But the number one thing in your life is your son, Larry. And with respect to John, John, there's certain issues that you have with Mary that I'm not going to be able to resolve today. But the way you light up when you talk about picking up Larry shows that he's the number one thing in your life. Is that true? And they both said yes. I said, so for the balance of the day, can we focus on what's in the best interest of Larry? And that's what I want to bring to Washington, because I'm not going to agree with everything that Senator McConnell or Senator Reid wants to do. But what I want to do is when I'm sitting down with them or the president is that we may not agree on everything, but can we focus today on what's in the best interests of the country? And that's the type of approach that I want to bring to government. So with that in mind, some of the issues that we raised in the brochure that was sent out to you, and hopefully want some of the reasons why you decided to come. What are my chances of winning in this race? Well, you know, I've really never looked at chances. I've looked at what needed to be done and whether I felt I could make a difference. When we did the recall of Governor Davis back in 2003, they gave us no chance of being successful. 21 times we've tried to recall a sitting governor, and it had never succeeded. So if I had looked at the odds, we never would have tried the 22nd time, and we were able to succeed. Similarly, redistricting had been tried for decades. We were taking on some of the most powerful forces in the state, and we were able to succeed there as well. So I look at more whether it can be done, whether it's something that should be done, and whether I could make a difference. Because in my life, my feeling is if you see something that's wrong and you do not do something about it, that's what I would have trouble with. So if I try something and it fails, that's fine. But if I see something that we can be doing different and better and I sit on the sidelines, I couldn't live with myself. So here is the path that I do see, and that is that we have in the June election, I think we're going to have about 50 to 53% of the people voting for Democrats, and we're going to have roughly 50 to 45% of the people voting for a Republican. That vote on the Democratic side looks like it's going to be split maybe 2-1, Democrat to Republican. And so if you take that vote, that gives Loretta Sanchez about 16 to 17% of the vote, and Kamala Harris maybe 33% of the vote. And in a top two election, where it's the top two that go on to the next level, that means if I get more than 17% of the vote, then I would go on to the next level. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to differentiate ourselves from the other two major Republicans, a guy by the name of Ron Unz and a guy by the name of Tom DelBaccaro. We are the only Republican that's in the voter guide. We are the only Republican that's getting major newspaper endorsements, and we've been very successful. We've basically cleaned up in the Central Valley from Sacramento down to Fresno. We've really shown a strong interest in that area, and I think they are on the cusp of having tremendous economic growth if we can resolve the water issue. If we focus on that, I think the Central Valley can take off and really be a place we could be very proud of over the next few decades. So that's how we plan to be successful in June, is coming out ahead of Loretta Sanchez. And then the fall, it's going to be a great discussion. And I mean a discussion, and I hope in the best form of the term. I'd love to have debates. Probably is going to be Kamala Harris. What is the role of government? Talking about these ideas. What is the role of donors and how much control they have over the process? How much the parties have control over the process? And I think that's going to be a really interesting discussion and an interesting debate, and I'm going to learn a lot from being involved in that process. What's my ability to win the crossover vote? I think in the fall, we have a great opportunity because on issue after issue, I think we're going to be able to say, well, I agree with Dianne Feinstein, but disagree with Kamala Harris. I agree with Jerry Brown, but disagree with Kamala Harris. I agree with Chuck Reed, who is the mayor of San Jose, disagree with Kamala Harris. So in our polling, when we look at the independent voter today, based on the issue, we're up 8% over Kamala Harris. The downside, clearly, is that nobody knows who we are. And that's the challenge that we have to overcome, is getting the name ID out there. So that's kind of my view of our chances, the crossover appeal. With respect to the national party, I think we're seeing the system on the Republican side break down. I'm seeing a huge disconnect, the biggest disconnect I have ever seen between the establishment and the base. Within the last 3 weeks, I would say 85% of the base is now behind Donald Trump. It's just amazing how they've come together and solidified around him, whereas the donors have not had such, have not coalesced around Trump in anywhere near that degree. On the Democrat side, I don't have as much of a window, but I think it's really amazing to me that you see Barbara Boxer being shouted down as not being liberal enough. That was just in Nevada. That was a real eye-opening experience. And to have Dianne Feinstein talk about she sees dangerous parallels between where they are today and 1968 in Chicago. So I think that both sides, you're seeing there being a huge disconnect between the establishment and the base because, again, I feel that the government system is not responding to the needs of the people. So on both sides, I think it is a challenge, but I also think it's a tremendous opportunity for a realignment and to have a government that's much more responsive to the people, also give people greater flexibility and freedom in their lives, and really lead to a more just society. So that's kind of the 30,000-foot view. Now I get to go to my favorite part of the presentation is to do the question and answers with Carson and to hear what you have to say that's what's on your mind. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Duff.
That's very different, by the way, than every presentation I give. But, you know, I just never, I don't have the opportunity to give that. And I really feel it's so important to understand what's going on from such a large perspective, because there is so much fear and so much anxiety out there. And I think I really just wanted to take the opportunity to say, hey, you know what? This thing is moving, and it can be moving in a very positive direction. So I apologize for taking this opportunity to do this, but I really felt it was important to put down that marker.
Thank you, Duff. Thanks for giving us plenty of time to get to the question and answers. I can tell you're not a politician at heart, because you didn't keep on going. We are here at the Commonwealth Club. Of course, this is Duff Sundheim, Republican candidate to represent California in the U.S. Senate and former chair of the California Republican Party. I'm Carson Bruno, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and I will be moderating this audience Q&A portion. We have a lot of great questions, so I'd like to get straight to it. I'll be filling in some of my own questions as well.
Great.
But to kick it off, after the 2012 presidential election, the RNC released a postmortem analysis, mm-hmm. which I think many people were aware of. Mm-hmm. And that examined what the Republican Party needed to do to change in order to broaden its appeal and hopefully be more successful right. in future elections. I'd like to quote one recommendation they had out of that report and then get your opinions on it. And I quote, "When it comes to social issues, the party must, in fact and indeed, be more inclusive and welcoming. If we are not, we will limit our ability to attract young people and others, including many women, who agree with us on some but not all issues. Do you agree with this recommendation? And if so, how will you, in fact and indeed, try to live out the recommendation?"
Yeah, I think it's extremely important. And I think that's one of the things that's going to happen when we complete this realignment. I think right now what's happening is that it's all being done on the emotional level. So I think that that's why Trump is able to take the position that he is and just kind of blow through stuff in terms of what he says about immigrants, what he says about women, you know, what he says about the social issues, because people really don't care. I mean, I got stopped at lunch today by three people that have never been involved in the political process, and all three of them said they're going to vote for Trump. And I was just amazed, because, you know, the feeling is it's the inside versus the outside. So that's what's going on right now. And that's how the game is going to be played. And frankly, that's why I think that the people in the Obama team are saying, hey, you guys are totally underestimating Trump, because he's tapping in to the anti-establishment perspective. And the more Hillary goes down the road she's going, she's just playing right into that by saying this weekend that Bill Clinton's going to be doing her economic policy. She's just playing right into that. But long term, after things settle down, we really do have to have a much more open-minded position to the social issues. And that's why, you know, my position on the social issues is I'm personally pro-life. My wife is personally pro-life. But when my dad was dying of Alzheimer's, we went to my mom's house, and my mom went into her bedroom, and my sisters went into their rooms. And the crying and the anguish that I heard in those rooms is something I hope you never have to experience. But I'm also sitting there thinking, do I really want some government official telling me whether or not we made the right decision? So at the end of the day, I believe that we have to have confidence that the people that are facing those horrendous situations, in consultation with their spiritual advisors and their doctors, will make the right choice. I think that's, you know, one way that we can be going with that issue. I think it's showing a sensitivity and an openness and a less of a rigidity. But again, I don't think that's going to be a big factor in 2016, but I think it's important that we stake out what our views are for the long term, and that's one of the positions that I think will be valuable. Also, that I think that extends into gay rights, transgender, all those types of issues, is I think that there will be a group that will come out of this saying, hey, we're for a liberty society. We think that the people should be making those decisions for themselves.
Could you touch a little bit more on the, especially the gay rights issues that are happening? We're seeing, particularly in North Carolina, particular, you know, the bathroom bills, they're really kind of being a flashpoint in today's society. It seems as if the bathroom situation and the transgender situation sure. is very similar to what we saw in 2004 right. and the early parts of the 2000 with the gay marriage issue right. at the state level. So how do you see yourself as a candidate, but also the Republican Party, kind of trying to attract the younger vote and as well as the gay community's vote?
Well, I think, again, it gets back to the example I gave of the parents that came in and they're just hell-bent for the confrontation. And so many of the issues I deal with as a mediator, people are focused on the conflict. And I think it was extremely unfortunate that the legislature in North Carolina, rather than sitting down with these with people in the transgender community who have obviously legitimate issues and need to feel comfortable with where they are, but there are also religious issues that need to be involved. But I think it was unfortunate that the people in North Carolina forced the issue through legislation. I think it's equally unfortunate that then the Obama administration forced the issue in terms of the executive order. This is exactly the type of situation where I think rather than the governmental heavy-handed use of their powers, either from the legislative or the executive branch, is not the way to go. And the way to go on issues like this is to work outside of the government, to sit down and say, okay, we've got some issues here. How can we resolve them? And that's what I want to try to bring to the whole process. Yes, it's within the government, but it also, again, this is what I'm talking about, is that we have this evolving role as to what the government's role is. And I think that we, because at the end of the day, what needs to happen is we need to work it out amongst each other. And if we do it either legislatively or executive order, I don't think we're doing that.
Excellent, excellent. One of our audience members wrote down, information does not equal knowledge. Knowledge does not equal wisdom. In today's world of a plethora of ways to get information, Twitter, social media, the blogs, how is there too much information out there for the average citizen, the average person to kind of consume? And if so, does that kind of is that helping to cause the kind of the partisanship nature we're seeing in today's society?
Absolutely. And you know, it's kind of interesting. I used to think that the road to wisdom was how much you knew, you know, and really now that I'm, and I really studied hard and I read a lot of books, and I've really learned that the road to wisdom is, I'm sorry, I forgot, I made a mistake, you know, so it's really kind of interesting that you understand the limitations of the knowledge of facts, and really it is more creating your having relationships and treating them as if you're fallible, because no matter how much knowledge you have, you still are a human being, and that kind of gets into the emotional side of things. But I think that the upside of it is, and there is an upside of it is, that we now have more information available. And so that knowledge is not, no longer has to be centralized in these great figures other than ourselves. We don't need to have some columnist tell us what we should be doing or some newspaper endorsement telling us how we can vote. So that's the positive side of things. But what we haven't been able to do is to process in such a way that we're able to deal with that in a constructive manner. And so how that all plays out, I don't know. I think, you know, I tell my wife that I want to be in rooms where there are people smarter than I am. And I think this is a great example of where we need to have people in the room that are smarter than I am trying to figure that out. My wife says, well, honey, if you want to be in rooms where people are smarter than you are, you can go just about anywhere you want. So, but as part of that process, I think that's really what we need to do. Is just, I think it'll play out over time, but it's going to take some time. This is a major, major change. And we were talking about that with George before the event, is that there's too much information now. You know, we can't keep up with our Twitter and email. So how do we do that? I don't know. But I think we'll be able to do that over time. And the benefits of having everybody have access to that information is invaluable. Just like it went back to the first age of reason, you know, the Catholic Church wouldn't let people read the Bible, right? I mean, they kept that information from them. And so then they read it, okay, and then you had the Reformation and all that. So I think access to information is valuable, but we also need to understand the limitations of it.
Great, great. Well, as we all know, it seems like every day we're seeing something in the news about an explosion here, an explosion there, something going on overseas.
Yes.
It seems as if, you know, regardless if you're in the Middle East, if you're in Asia, even Europe, the world is less safe than it used to be. It seems to be this least safe time, you know, in modern times. What role do you see the United States playing in trying to make the world a safer place? And what principles do you live by to determine whether the U.S. should engage internationally or not?
Sure. So I think it starts with an overall vision of what your strategic strategy is, and I don't think we have one fully developed, and I would love to be part of that process. I think that the closest, The person that got closest to getting it right was Truman after World War II. And he developed the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and NATO. So it was a combination of economic policy, political policy, and the military. And it was all three of those. And that is what I think we need to do. So we need to come up with what is our strategy in each of those regions. In Europe, we did it around our number one ally, which was England. We need to do that in the Middle East around our number one ally, Israel. In Asia, we need to do it around Japan and Korea, but have the overall strategy of what do we want in terms of people's political and individual freedom, what do we want in terms of the economic structure, and then the military should be the third component. And then within the military, I think there are four components of military action. One is intelligence, which is non-lethal. Second is diplomacy, which is non-lethal. Third is cybersecurity. And I think that if you want to look at where I would call for the biggest change between existing policy and future policy, I think we're spending way too much time and energy focusing on the past wars and not enough on the future wars. And I think the cyber wars are a major threat and needs our attention. And then the fourth is the actual use of military force. But even there, you're going to see, I call them robots, and a guy from Northrop Grumman said, no, they're self-activating military units. But that whole role, you know, that whole avenue of weapon versus machine versus machine, we're a lot closer to that than people realize. But I still think, as a United States senator, I want to be able to look every parent in the eye that I unfortunately have to go to where their child gave their life for our country and say, I understand why that person made that sacrifice. And I think in too many parts of the world, we don't have a clear idea of what our interests and what our values are in those different regions. And I would really focus on trying to understand that and then have the different policies underneath that.
Do you think NATO today is an outdated sort of mode of using military and diplomacy, given the fact that NATO was designed to as containment against the Soviet Union? Nowadays, our enemies could be anywhere, whether they're states or non-state actors. So do you feel like there needs to be an update to NATO, or do you think just kind of revitalizing NATO would be sufficient?
No, I think we need to look at it fresh. And then I'm always one that if you have an existing structure, use that existing structure, and there's some real benefits to that. But I think we saw in the Belgium bomb explosions just the limitations of NATO, because it was very clear that different parts of the Belgium government had a much better relationship with our security people than they did with each other. So, and they really aren't doing a very good job of keeping track of who's coming in and out of Europe. And therefore, that's leaving us vulnerable because we have such a low standard as to who can come from Europe to the United States. So I would say that's a great example of where we have something that was really important historically, but would need to have a major overhaul in terms of what its role is going forward because of the asymmetric threat that you talked about.
Excellent. Switching gears a little bit. Republican Party hasn't won a Senate race since Pete Wilson.
Really? Didn't know that.
I'm sure nobody ever reminds me of it. And, you know, generally you see a lot of legislative gridlock, both in Sacramento as well as Washington, D.C. A lot of people are really fed up with both parties, right, with politicians in general, with the status quo. Right. What reforms do you think you would bring or would advocate for? Term limits, you know, open primaries. Do you think there's anything that can be done to kind of make Washington, D.C. work?
Yeah, different approach and different people. You know, I was a business lawyer for 20 years, and I knew any time I went to look at what the Articles of Incorporation or the bylaws were, we were in trouble. Right? It really was, that's not what made the system work. That's not what made the deals happen. It was the people. And so my feeling is, if we find, just as, you know, you had Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, you know, there was a small group of swing people on that court that enabled things to get done. My view is I'm looking for that small group of people on both sides of the aisle that have that type of approach. I think Sass from Nebraska has that approach. Joe Manchin from West Virginia, a Democrat, has that type of approach. Susan Collins, a Republican, has that type of approach. So I think it's really more the people that make the difference. There, you can have some changes in the rules, and I've been willing to change the rules, you know, redistricting and open primary and the like, but I really think the much bigger component is the quality of the people and the perspective that those people bring to the job.
Now that you're a candidate operating under California's open primary top two system, do you like it? Do you think we should change? Should we go back? Are there other reforms we could do?
Right.
Should we let it play out for a little bit longer?
Yeah, I still think it was positive, and I think, frankly, it was positive for the Republican Party. It hasn't been positive for me, but because right now we have two Democrats and three Republicans, and in a state where the Republicans are the minority, that really requires a much greater coalition, and that's why I went to Rocky Chavez and Tom Del Beccaro early on and said, hey, let's develop some objective criteria, and whoever is out front in February, the other two should get behind him, and Rocky agreed to that plan, and Tom Del Beccaro, I just read in the paper yesterday, the reason he didn't agree to it is that he didn't think I was going to live by that agreement. and so he decided to go ahead. But I think if you look at it, even from a partisan perspective, you look at the Catherine Baker race in the East Bay. No way, you know, we haven't won there in decades. Why did we win? Because the Democrats were split. It provided us with an opportunity. David Hadley in L.A., Scott Wilk in L.A. And then you also have the situation where you have the Dem-on-Dem races like the Berman-Sherman race where they chewed up billions or millions of dollars. So I think it's the right system. I also think it's good for the Republicans. And I think that that it's something that the Democrats don't like is being borne out by the fact that I'm almost, I could bet my fair amount of money that they will be putting out an initiative in 2018 to undo it because they do not like the way it plays out. I do think it gets the best people into the system, and it requires everybody to compete for every vote. Because right now in the primary system, in June, historically, you would have everybody on my side going as far right as you could and everybody on the Democratic side going far left because those are the people that tend to show up in June. So those elections were over in June. This way, you have the two most competitive people. And if we aren't able to put together a competitive candidate in the Senate that is able to emerge, then shame on us. And we should focus on what we need to do to make ourselves stronger and more competitive.
As a shameless plug, the Hoover Institution will be putting out our next issue of Eureka, which is our California-centric web publication. And this issue is going to be focused on the pros and cons of Proposition 14, which, of course, created California's top two system.
So you're going to give us a preview of what you guys decided, Carson?
Well, you know, the pro side, you know, it does seem the state legislature is moderating. It does seem that more moderates are moving into the state legislature. That seems to be happening mostly on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. And Pete Peterson, Dean of the Pepperdine School of Public Policy, wrote that piece. Stephen Greenhut wrote the con piece, and he looks at it from a perspective of voter choice. It has decimated minor party and independent candidates on the November ballot, and that is a significant concern moving forward.
And I would say to that is that you're right. They're not on the November ballot,
yeah.
But they need to shift to understand that the game is played in June now.
Yep.
And what they haven't understood is that they were not winning. I mean, they say, yeah, okay, they're not there in November. Well, how many times did they win in November, right? Never. So it really, they just need to change the game, and it enables them to get on the, it gives them a better chance of getting on the ballot if they do it in June. But I guess that I'm arguing with Stephen, and we'll move on.
It does create a fascinating political science research
area.
Yeah. Moving on to economic growth. Last Friday, we had some good news for California. Mm-hmm. Our unemployment rate dropped to 5.2%, the lowest level since June 2007. However, there is still a lot of bad news on the economic front. You know, one in five Californians live in poverty, according to the joint venture between PPIC and the Stanford Center for Poverty and Inequality. And real income, household income in California is still about 10% below pre-recession levels. So what would you do to ensure that the economic growth we are seeing gets into all California households?
Well, first of all, I would say that that unemployment figure is a joke. You know, it is a 1930s model based on, you know, assuming that everybody who works has an eight-hour job in some factory and is working full-time.
I think it, I think you just won the Economist vote with that.
But it's just, you know, if you work a few hours, right, or you have two jobs and you're working 20 hours a week, you're employed. I mean, that's ridiculous. You're not able to take care of your family. So I think that we need to come up with measures of what's really going on in people's lives. And that, again, is, you know, we're stuck in the 1930s, and we need to understand just how much people are suffering. 64% of the people in the state are living paycheck to paycheck. That's outrageous. So what would I do about it? I mean, that's the whole thing, is that, you know, I was working as a mediator and working on education reform in East San Jose, and I saw this suffering. It was unbelievable. We've suffered an economic earthquake. On one side of the fault line, we've seen one of the greatest accumulations of wealth in the history of civilization. But you go across the other side of that fault line, and there are the people living in poverty. You know, you see people scooping out macaroni and cheese, put one scoop on their kid's plate, and the bowl goes back in the refrigerator because that's that kid's lunch the next day. So I would say there's a three-point plan that I focus on, and that is greater access to capital. The community banks were decimated under Dodd-Frank, and we need to have different lending standards for those small businesses, especially in minority communities. That's when I grew up in Chicago. You know, you had the Italian community, the Czech community, the Polish community, but they all had their community banks. They all had the way to get access to capital. So that's number one. Number two is lower the marginal tax rates. George and I were talking about, you know, the impact of all this money is overseas. How do we bring it back home? And I think one of the things we can do is if we're giving away $1 trillion in certain benefits to larger companies for the most part, if we get rid of a lot of those benefits and lower the marginal rates, you will enable small businesses to better compete, and small businesses are the engine of economic growth. And you also would get all that money coming back from overseas and start investing in the United States again. And third is the regulatory process. And we talked about how difficult that is. The people I was talking with today, the small business people that feel that they can't get things done, and that even rules and regulations that you don't really understand what their impact would be. They were talking about the impact of the Affordable Care Act and how they're spending $120,000 a year on health insurance, which is going to a small percentage of their workers are really benefiting from that additional coverage, but all of their employees, they can't give them a pay raise because all of the money is going to this additional health care insurance. So I think we have to look at the entire structure. But there is, I think, the closest thing to the silver bullet that I've seen, and that's water. And the way I would look at this is that right now we have more than enough water that comes down from the mountains. And frankly, you know, look out the door. I mean, there's the Pacific Ocean. And if we developed a water policy that made sense and you took, you, whether it's you increase the above ground storage or below ground storage, or you increase the desalinization plants, or you have recycling plants, all of those plants could be built in what's called revenue bonds. The difference between a general obligation bond and a revenue bond is that the general obligation bond is the obligation of all of the taxpayers. If you have a revenue bond, that's paid for the people that use the water. And there are people that are dying to have this additional water. So if you develop those different water policies, you then can build more houses, because right now we can't build more houses because we don't have a source for the water. We're building less than 100,000 new units a year. So it's no surprise that the housing prices in California are 240% of the national average. So if you had water going to these facilities, you could be building these new houses, you'd be creating great construction jobs, you would be lowering the pressure on the housing prices. And where's the center of the universe of high housing prices? It's right here in San Francisco. So that would be a double benefit. You would be able to increase the amount of agricultural jobs, which would be great, more jobs. You would lower the cost of food. You wouldn't have to import the food from overseas, so you lower the amount of global warming. I've just named five things that you can do by just solving the water problem. So we have the three-point plan, but I think we really need to be focusing on making sure that we have an adequate supply of water, because you cannot understand either the history or the future of California without understanding its link between California's future and water.
On a similar topic, on this note, on income and particularly income inequality, California just passed a new minimum wage increase,
yes.
$15 an hour by 2023, right. for small right. businesses. You've mentioned that you don't think that's the right approach. Right. What do you think is a better alternative to minimum wage?
Well, first of all, let me start with saying that I see how people are struggling. And we have, I believe in social justice. And so I think that if you're working that 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, you should not be living in poverty. So then the question is, what tools do we use to get them to that position? And my concern is that the minimum wage is not the most effective way to go. And I'll kind of break forward and go forward. I think a much more effective tool is what's called the earned income tax credit. And the way that works is if we say, okay, the poverty line is $30,000 and you make $27,000, the government will write you a check for $3,000 per year so that you're not living in poverty. That's, I just think, the cost to a society that's just and fair. Now, the minimum wage, I spent way too much time between Bakersfield and Sacramento. They cannot support $15 an hour. And you will see, just like you're seeing them uproot all the orchards and the fields where there once were thriving agricultural businesses, you now see desert. You're going to see that in those communities. Bakersfield will dry up. Merced will dry up. Modesto will dry up because they can't afford $15 an hour. Now, if you're going to do that in San Francisco, okay, that makes sense. If you're going to do it in LA or Silicon Valley, that makes sense. But it doesn't make sense in other regions of the state. And that's where I think it's a great example of where you have this policy. I mean, who in the world knows 7 years from now whether $15 an hour is going to be the right rate? That is the cumbersome overregulation of business taking on something that is a legitimate concern, but where the government isn't the best adept at being able to handle that. I think that's where Oregon has done a much better job of that, where they have it much more regionally based. So I'm not anti-minimum wage. I'm not against somebody earning a good day's pay for a good day of work. I'm just really concerned that this is not the right surgery for the patient.
For those listening on the radio, we're listening to the Commonwealth Club of Program, Commonwealth Club of California program. Our guest is Duff Sundheim, Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. I'm Carson Bruno, research fellow at the Hoover Institution, and I'm your moderator.
And my website is DuffSundheimForSenate.com.
Oh, excellent. You can hear the Commonwealth programs on the radio or catch our program videos at the club's YouTube channel. So getting right back to the questions now.
Yeah.
In 2015, California exported $165 billion to a total of 229 countries, the top five being Mexico, Canada, China, Japan, and Hong Kong. The past year has been consumed with discussions about whether we should ratify the Trans-Pacific Partnership, right. TPP. In 2015, those 11 nations that are part of the TPP accounted for 42% of California's exports.
Yes.
Do you support the TPP? Why or why not?
So I'm a strong supporter of trade. I mean, you have to be if you're in California. And especially, you mentioned some really important statistics, but 41% of all trade that comes into the United States comes in through California ports. Mm-hmm. So again, you can't have a strong California without strong trade. But I am deeply concerned that the TPP, as it's currently written, doesn't take into account the real needs of the workers. I think there are three aspects of a trade deal. One is it's opening up foreign markets to American goods. I think TPP does a good job of that. The second component is whether it provides cheaper goods for Americans here at home. And I think historically our trade deals have done a good job at that. But the people that have an interest in doing these trade deals are those two groups. Those that are trying to expand American jobs and American products and have them be bought overseas, and also those that want to import products from overseas into the United States. We haven't had somebody at the table that has been looking at what is the long-term interest of the workers. And again, this is something that George and I were talking about. I think we have a responsibility to, as part of these trade deals, to look at how can we bring manufacturing back from China? How can we bring these good-paying jobs and stop having Nabisco, Carrier, all these companies going down to Mexico and then selling those products right back here in the United States. So I'm not anti-trade, but I think we need to do a much better job in our trade deals. And that third component, what's in the best interest of the American worker, is going to be my focus, not to the detriment of the other two, but to really make sure that that voice is also heard in that process.
We are sitting here in the heart of Silicon Valley, and there are a few questions from the audience talking about what is Silicon Valley's role in, you know, either helping the government, whether it's from a foreign policy, national security perspective, but can Silicon Valley cross the line, as we might have seen with the NSA issue and the a lot of the privacy issues over the past few years?
Yeah, this is really tough, and I think it's really an important issue. I think what was really discouraging to me is that when you look at the Apple FBI deal as to whether or not they should turn over that phone, the law that the FBI was using was literally written with a quill in the 18th century. And so, you know, I think we have developed some since then. And so what I want to do is have modern legislation that looks at what the relationship is between the companies, what their obligations are, what their responsibilities are, and the serious threats that we pay, that we face. What I would have done in this situation and the legislation I'm going to work for, on, is that you have to look at, before you require Apple or anybody else to be actively engaged in this process, you have to look at the immediacy of the threat. Now, in the San Bernardino case, there was no immediacy of a threat. The two people that were involved had both died. So you didn't have that immediacy of the threat. You didn't even have the scope of the threat. So it wasn't somebody that was saying, okay, I'm going to blow up this airline today if you don't do this. And third, it was requiring that entity, Apple, to actively engage in fixing the problem. It wasn't just turning over the keys. It was they were going to be required by the government to have involuntary servitude to fix this problem. So all three components were missed in that case. So I would bring those into play. If it's immediate, if it's major, then maybe you can require the person to intercede. But you do face the risk, if you push too hard on that, on those companies, you will push them overseas, because they don't want to be faced with a situation where if we tell them that's what they have to do here, well, then what are the Chinese going to say? What are the Russians going to say? They're going to want to have the same set of rules apply to them. So it's a very complicated issue. But this is, again, you know, just as we were talking about with the transgender issue, that's not, I think, an appropriate issue to be played out in the courts or through executive action. Similarly, I think this is the type of thing we need to sit down in a room and come out with legislation that we can all work with, all live with.
So this is probably the question you were dreading that I wouldn't ask you.
Uh-oh.
But it's on everyone's mind, because I've been getting quite a few note cards about this.
Trump.
As a mediator, you probably are an excellent judge of character.
So what are
your opinions of our presidential candidates?
So, you know, what you do learn is that you learn not to judge. I remember my first... I'm not going to duck it. But I remember the first mediation case I had. This guy had stolen money from this couple. And when the couple figured out that this guy had stolen the money, the husband of the person who had the money stolen from them had a heart attack. And so, you know, and I'm there mediating how this, you know, so I'm trying to figure out how can I, you know, look at this guy and say, you son of a gun, and not reach across the table and grab him by the neck. So you do have to really kind of be dispassionate about it and try to look at it from their position. Frankly, the interesting thing about that, by 2 o'clock, I had worked out the economic aspects of that transaction. But what I spent, because the guy had gone and gambled the money away, he didn't have the money. So it was going to have to be paid off after a long period of time, secured by a note on the property. They went to the same church together. So I spent between 2 and 5 o'clock trying to repair the relationship, because they were going to see each other on Sunday. And at the end of 5 o'clock, the woman went over and hugged the guy. So, I mean, I really felt like that I'd really done my job. So now I'm going to have to wade into much deeper water. So I feel like, again, Trump has tapped in to the emotional side of things. And so I think that if he's able to put together a team, you know, that outsider perspective could be beneficial. I think that people underestimate just how valuable experience is. And people make the comparison between Schwarzenegger and Trump, and I dismiss it a little bit because I actually, you know, feel I know Schwarzenegger pretty well and don't know Trump. But Schwarzenegger made a lot of mistakes early on just because he had no experience in government. I mean, when we choose somebody to do eye surgery, we want to know how they've done in eye surgery. And to hand over the keys to one of the most important jobs in the world with actually no experience at that, I'm really deeply concerned about that. So I have not taken a position with him because I want to get a much greater sense of the man and whether he has those types of innate abilities, such as Abraham Lincoln, who turned out to be pretty good without that experience. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, has all that experience, but there's a real question, I think, about her judgment. So, you know, there's no easy answer. There's no ideal situation. It's a human process. But I still want to learn much more about both of these individuals, and I think that we're not done seeing major surprises here in 2006. What I saw in 2006, and the reason I ran, is I saw the frustration of the average person with the political process. But what I missed completely is I never saw Trump or Sanders as the people that would grab onto that in such an effective way. But it is a very important time in our history. And again, that's why I started off with the presentation I did, because right now we're having trouble making sense of all this. But I think it is the end of one era and the beginning of a new era. And I'm really optimistic about where that new era could lead us.
It certainly is a fascinating time, a fascinating election, that's for sure. I'm going to turn to education because I know this has been a important issue to you for quite some time. And I'd like to kind of hear your thoughts about how we can kind of, you know, try to revitalize California's education system. I first wanted to read a PPIC study did a great analysis looking at how our workforce quality moving into the future. And they predict that our economy is going to demand about 4 in 10 workers to have college degrees, but yet only 3 in 10 are projected to have college degrees. On the flip side, the economy is only going to demand about 10% of those without high school degrees, but yet 20% are going to have no high school degree. Mm-hmm. So this is a serious issue on an economic issue, but also talks about a little bit about how California's K-12 education quality, but also higher education quality. What do you think needs to be done for the state to really try to get its education back on track?
Right.
And what role do you see the federal government playing?
Well, the federal government's role primarily is to get out of the way. I mean, the one area where I still think that the federal government has an important role, and again, I think this shows my bias, is their commitment to special ed and people with disabilities and how people learn in a different manner. I mean, that's, you know, with my brother, that was a key thing, is that he needed a different system rather than the standard system. But I think statewide, to be perfectly frank, I think that the union is the huge impediment. And we had a court case called the Vergara case where 9 poor school children went before the judge and said that the education system in California shocks the conscience and violates our children's constitutional rights. And that judge agreed with that decision. And instead of the Attorney General, Kamala Harris, enforcing that decision and protecting those children's constitutional rights, the teachers' unions got her to appeal that decision, and the implementation of those constitutional rights have been blocked. Do you know in the last 10 years, do you know how many, we have hundreds of thousands of teachers. In the last 10 years, do you know on average how many teachers are dismissed for poor quality of teaching? 9. 9 teachers out of hundreds of thousands. And so the rules and the limitations of being able to get rid of people that can't do the job need to be fundamentally changed. And I think that, again, we have way too much, it's that centralization of power, in this case, in the state. Also, from a technological perspective, we now have the ability to treat different children differently. You know, my wife lost both of her parents as a child. She got knocked off the map twice and lost her brother in the military. So she, you know, had a tough time staying in tune with the educational system as a child. She went back to college at the age of 50, and by the time she was 55, she'd graduated Phi Beta Kappa. But it was, you know, she went about it a different route. People in South Central LA, you know, they're living in unsteady households or people in foster care. So I think, you know, rather than putting kids on the assembly line when they're 5 years old, punch them, stamp them, test them down the line and hope that when they're 18, they come out, you know, they haven't been destroyed by the system. I think that's totally wrong way to do it. I think what we need to do is look at what the individual is capable of and developing a program that's designed for that individual. And with technology, we can do that. So lower the power, lower the authority of Washington, lower the power of the teachers union in California, and shift the focus to have be the primary focus be on the student rather than the system.
Excellent. To that point, you mentioned the power and the influence of the teachers unions in their education. There's also a lot of influence amongst corporations, particularly in campaign finance laws,
yes,
in lobbying, in special interests, just in general. What do you think needs to be done in order to try to get special interests out of you know, the legislation making process and make it more about, you know, the people?
It's a corrupt system, and it's only not illegal because the people that benefit from it set the rules. But it is a corrupt system, and the more money you have, the more power and influence you have over the system. Bill Bradley was at Stanford back in 1999, and I really enjoyed getting to know him that year. And one day we played a game because we both, my honors thesis at Stanford was on campaign finance reform. And so we sat down, and I came up with a campaign finance reform proposal, and his job was to knock it down. And then he would come up with a campaign finance proposal, and I would knock it down. And every proposal we came up with, the counter-argument was stronger than the argument itself. So I think it's very difficult to get the money out of the system. But there's no question that it's corrupting, and it's no question it has a negative impact on our society. One proposal I had, which I don't know how practical it is, but it is that everybody can contribute as much as they want, but they have to make that contribution into a blind trust. And so you never, the politician would never know who made that contribution. So you could write a check for $20 million, submit it into that blind trust and say, okay, I want this money to go to Bernie Sanders. But Bernie could never know where that $20 million came from. So you could have the benefit of using your free speech to benefit that candidate, but the person that made the contribution wouldn't have the corrupting benefit of saying, hey, Bernie, you know, you owe me. And I just don't know how practical that is, but that's my proposal for tonight.
Do you think that would be a big shakeup.
Yeah.
Do you think technology can play a better role in campaign finance reform now,
yes,
than it could have, you know, in the 70s?
Absolutely.
And since?
Yeah, well, what we've done is that we've lowered the amount that you can contribute close to the candidate, right? So we pushed it farther and farther out. I think the biggest example of that was when Al Gore bought Current TV, right, to really buy a network where the whole goal of it was to change the political dialogue. So you just force it farther and farther out. One possibility could be that you can accept as much money as you want within the campaign, but it has to be disclosed, and you have to then go and show, okay, here are my top five donors, you know, these five corporations or these five unions. That would definitely be an intermediate step, which I think could be beneficial.
I always like to, when I say, you know, money in politics is kind of like, you know, a water flowing downhill. You can put up a dam, but it's always going to find some way around that dam and into the pond below.
And that's what we found in 1999, and we haven't been able to find the elixir yet.
Well, unfortunately, we only have time for one more question. And I'd kind of like you to talk a little bit more about why you as a candidate. You know, we have 34 candidates that are going to be on the Senate ballots. How many of you are vote-by-mail voters?
Yeah.
Do you, So we are now in the voting stage. We have been for quite some time already. And when you look at that ballot, I just filled out mine yesterday. It's quite daunting. I mean, when you look at all those names. So why you versus the other 33 on that ballot?
Well, my role model is a man by the name of George Shultz, who was President Reagan's Secretary of State. And after 9/11, I went to him and I said, hey, you know, I'm done making money. I really want my life to be about service. Can you help me get a job in Washington? He goes, you want your life to be about service, but you want to go to Washington. Think again. So we then developed a program where we would work together to try to bring about political reform here in California. And he had me read a plaque that was given to him by President Reagan and said, there's no limit what a person can achieve if he doesn't care who gets the credit. So I always thought I'd be a behind-the-scenes guy. And so I went with him with this idea. I said, hey, I think, you know, there's this breakdown in Washington, and I think I can do something about it. What do you think? And he said, well, to be a good senator, you have to have two characteristics. One, you have to have certain intellectual capability. And second, no matter how many great ideas you have, if you don't have the ability to convince 59 other people that that job, that that position makes sense, you're not going to be successful.
Because of the filibuster.
Because of the filibuster rule. And so I think I have repeatedly shown my ability to get the difficult stuff done and to build those coalitions, bipartisan coalitions, to get things done. And I think I also, on a personal note, I think I'm empathetic enough. I really want to do this not for me or my career, but because I love this state and I love this country and I want to make a contribution. I know that's as corny as all get out, but it also happens to be the truth. So ability to get things done, ability to make a difference, and try to do it with a great deal of humility and a great deal of love and respect for the people I'd be representing.
Well, thank you, Duff, for letting us get to know you better. Thank you to the audience for some great questions. This brings us to the conclusion of our program. You've been watching and listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program with guest Duff Sundheim, Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or catch our program videos on the club's YouTube channel. Thank you and have an excellent evening.
Thanks a lot, Carson.
Thank you.